Hello and welcome to C2Y Podcast. Today I'm speaking with Kyan Tamarek. Kyan started working as a youth trainer with Connect to Youth in 2008. While working with C2Y, she began doing education and outreach with the TRIP Project, a grassroots harm reduction initiative that provides safer sex and drug information to Toronto's electronic music communities. Kyan is now facilitating art for young people through Delisle Youth Services. I asked Kyan to come and have a discussion with me today because her journey from someone who has access services to someone that provides services is one that I think we can all learn from. Welcome, Kyan.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. So let's start with where you're working now.
Right now I work for a youth center around Yonge and Eglinton. Our mandate is to work with youth ages 13 to 21, and we don't have any specific demographics that we work with. It's just whoever shows up to the youth center.
Right. So Yonge and Eglinton here in Toronto.
That's correct.
What sort of work are you doing there?
I wear a lot of hats. So I have to actually coordinate activities for the youth center, run programming, monitor the floor while we're open, make sure that the kitchen is stocked. There's a team of four of us who do all of this, and the work is pretty tight for all of us. Like, we've all got our shoulders full.
Yes, welcome to youth work. I'm really intrigued with that journey from a young person who accessed services to someone who's now providing services. Can we start with some of your experiences as a young person and how you started to access services originally?
I guess so. I don't know how far back you want to go. I was raised into a very poor household growing up. My father was... He had some of his own problematic behaviors. He was a little bit abusive when it came to my mother. She did her best to try to hide that from us for my brother and I for our entire childhood, and did a really good job of it, actually. I didn't even really know how bad things really were until very recently. Still, though, like, they got divorced when I was 9, not really having much of a father figure presence in my life, and then living with a single mother who was completely overworked and totally unprepared for having kids didn't really lead to having a whole lot of stability in my life. We moved around a lot. I've never lived anywhere longer than 2 years. And it was when I turned 18 that things started to get really dark. I started experiencing really, really severe depression. I came out as transgendered. And my mother's third husband, who was living with us at the time, was an alcoholic. And so it was just a toxic environment living at home, and I couldn't handle it. And so I eventually had to move out, and then I wound up losing that place, having a nervous breakdown, winding up on the streets, living in shelters. And that was the start of its own saga.
Sounds like quite the saga. And that's when you really began accessing youth services.
That's really when I started, yeah.
What are some of the services that were helpful for you?
When I was 18 and living on the streets, in order to keep me from living on the streets, I accessed the YWCA in my hometown for a little while. That was really, really good for a couple of weeks until the other shelter residents found out that I was transgendered, and then that did not go so well. I didn't even go to shelter staff for assistance. I just didn't want to deal with it. I left. There, I started living on the streets in the winter, and that was terrible in so many ways. Sleeping on freezing concrete at 4 in the morning when the world is at its darkest and its coldest is not an experience that I would want anyone to have to go through.
What allowed you to keep going through those? You talk about depression, you talk about some of those struggles, and here you are in your mid-20s as somebody who's now working with youth. So what there's 8 years in there. And what's allowed that movement?
Oh, some of it was luck and some of it was tenacity and some of it was just plain survival. There were periods of my life. There have been periods of entire years of my life where I was not living, I was surviving. It was like a day-to-day struggle to stay alive. And, you know, to stay alive means to stay sheltered, to stay fed, to take care of myself. At very, very dark times, it also meant not killing myself, which is something that it's just an issue that I've lived with for a very, very long time. And that's still a struggle to this day. Like, but I'm a lot better now than I used to be. A lot of it did actually come down to luck, too. Like, there were a couple of instances where somebody reached out a helping hand, and if they hadn't done that, like, I don't even know where I would be.
Who were those people?
Christian Seidel was somebody who I met who I was living in a shelter at the time. There were bed bugs. I was sharing a room with, like, eight people. It was a totally unsafe space. I was in post-traumatic stress all the time. And this person met me and said to me, the night that he met me, do you want to move in and crash on my couch? And that was incredible. He kept me housed for like 6 months or something, and he kept me fed. And that actually, that gave me the stability that I needed to actually regain a part of myself that I had lost. And when his partner and he moved to another place and we parted ways, I had gotten on financial assistance at that point, and I had managed to find housing at that point. So, I mean, if not for him, I really have no idea where I would be.
And he was another young person, or he was a youth worker?
No, he was just a guy that I met through a friend. He was just some guy. And, you know, like, he asked me if I wanted to stay the night because we were watching movies. I said, no, I have to go back to the shelter. He said, oh, how's that? I said, it's terrible. He says, why don't you move in with me? And, like this really was, like, the first day that I met this person. It's really kind of incredible. Like, you really don't see things like that very often.
Mm-hmm. Why have you chosen to work in this field?
I actually really didn't choose to work in this field. I wound up getting, you know, I wound up on financial assistance, and then I got housing, and then I had to start trying to find work. And being trans, at the time I was addicted to drugs, being, like, having post-traumatic stress disorder and bipolar disorder and suffering from hypomania and depression all the time, I really went with work that I could do, and that was usually very small peer-based initiatives that generally didn't pay very well but gave my life, like, a tiny bit of structure. And so I would, you know, work tiny, barely paid contract position after tiny, barely paid contract position. But they built up, and I needed to do something with my time. I couldn't just, like, I couldn't go back to the life that I had before. I couldn't go back to the streets. It was so horrible that I wanted to work as hard as I had to in order to get away from that. And so I really didn't choose the path that I've taken. Like, I went one handhold at a time, and this is where it has taken me.
And what are your thoughts about where you are right now?
It's still really hard. It's been years that I've been fighting, and I'm still fighting on a regular basis. It's still hard to find work. With the current political climate, like, finding work in the social services field without a post-secondary education is hard. It is just hard. And the work that I am expected to do, or that I would be expected to do in these positions, is something that would be really, really maybe quite easy for somebody who's able-minded and not suffering from stigma and discrimination around queer and trans issues.
Let's talk about some of that stigma around queer and trans issues.
Well, let's start maybe by talking a bit about what transgenderism is, and then we can talk a bit more about your specifics, if that works for you.
Yeah. So transgenderism is kind of an umbrella term that qualifies a whole bunch of different things that basically mean not clearly fitting into the male-female gender binary. So traditionally it means somebody who's either the trans part comes from transitioning from male to female or female to male. In the past couple decades, gender equity rights and gender issues have really come a startlingly long way, and now we've got a bunch of genders and a bunch of identities and a bunch of ways of referring to people. And so transgender is just kind of this way of saying, like, does not fit into the gender binary.
And where would you see yourself on that playing field?
Yeah, so it varies a lot. I identify as gender fluid because, like, as a single body, my gender changes. And so I'm not always the same, and I don't always have the same wants, and I don't always have the same needs. This was really confusing throughout my transition because, like, I would start on, like, a really high dose of hormones, and then I'd feel really, really awesome about it for a while, but then eventually, once I had my features had feminized to a certain point, then I would start to get dysphoric again. And so then I might, like, stop hormones and keep going without them, and then my features would start to masculinize again, and I'd start to get really dysphoric again, and then I'd, like, switch back and forth. It's taken me, like, 8 or 9 years now to come up with a hormone regimen that actually works for me and my lifestyle and that is sustainable. And that took a lot of trial and error. I've been through puberty like 6 times.
Once seems bad enough.
It is. It really is just as bad the 6th time through.
Right. And so do you still see yourself as gender fluid at this point in time, and that your gender may continue to shift as you move through the rest of your life?
More or less, yeah. I sort of house different selves or different personalities within my own head, and each of us has a different gender. So depending on who I am on any given day, that will inform how I identify.
So let me talk a bit about youth workers and some of the struggles that might present for people working with you. What has been your experience working with different youth organizations and individuals within those organizations being genderqueer?
So accessing services with most service users, like other shelter participants, I have received a lot of transphobia. I've received a lot of harassment. I've received a lot of verbal violence. I've received a lot of threats of physical violence. It really took a very extreme amount of effort to get as far as I have come without being seriously physically harmed. As far as service providers go, most often what I have found are instances of people who sort of get that trans and queer issues are important and sort of get that people need help with protection but don't really know how and kind of want to but feel kind of helpless because they don't really know what to do.
And so how do we help?
It's such a huge question. And that really is going to vary a lot from person to person, but there are certain things that are just that sort of go across the whole floor. Like, for instance, if you're not transgendered, don't assume that you know anything about the issues transgendered people face. Because something that shocks people quite often is how much trouble I have using public washrooms. And people are like, oh, yeah, it's just a public washroom. Yeah, just use the washroom over there. But it's like, No, going into a public washroom means risking somebody harassing me or threatening me with violence. It's a nerve-wracking experience, and every time I use a public washroom, I have to hype myself up for it. This kind of thing just, it tears you down and it eats away at you. And even though any one instance of this happening isn't usually horrible, this kind of thing happening over and over and over and over and over again and having to be in hypervigilance mode all the time completely wears you down and wears you out.
And so how can allies, you know, don't assume we understand the situation, everything from going to the washroom, which many of us don't even think about. We just go to the washroom. Mm-hmm. I hear this sense of struggle. I hear this. You've used the word fighting repeatedly around depression, around transgender issues. How do we ally as youth workers with young people who are fighting transphobia, with young people who are fighting depression, with young people who are fighting to survive?
The first thing that I can think of is to talk to queer and trans folk, and this, you know, goes for other groups as well. This also goes for people with mental health and addictions. This also goes for other marginalized groups. Talking to people, and not just talking, but listening. Asking people questions and then really listening to what they have to say and waiting until they're done talking before providing input. Because something that has happened to me before and something that's kind of aggravating is when I go to somebody and ask for assistance or ask for help, even if that help is just, I need a shoulder to vent. I need somebody to vent before I explode. Getting a sentence into my story and then having that person try to fix it, or having that person try to problem solve, or having that person try to somehow solve the situation. A lot of the times, these are not situations that can be solved. And something that's aggravated me a lot has been like, hey, like this and this and this is happening. Oh, have you tried this? Yes, of course I've tried that. I've been trying that for 5 years now. Things like that happen very often. So talking is important and listening is very, very important. Also, standing up for people when comments get made offhand, regardless of whether or not a marginalized person is present, is a super, super good way to be an ally. So, for instance, something that comes up really often is the use of the word gay as a negative word. So someone would be like, yeah, man, I hated it. The movie was so gay and it just sucked. And when that happens, like, I will challenge people on it. And I will say, really? Like, do you have to use that word? And sometimes people will get it and they'll be like, oh, yeah, sorry, it was a habit. I didn't mean to. You know, if a person recognizes that it's problematic, then you can kind of drop it for a little bit, but, you know, be ready to address it again. Sometimes if you try to force the issue too much on a person too fast, then they'll get really, really defensive. So sometimes if somebody says something problematic, you just want to address it and let them move on. Even if you haven't, like, totally 100% fully deconstructed the entire social enigma of the entire situation, just addressing it is sometimes enough for the time being.
Nice. How has it been being trans and working as a youth worker?
It goes pretty well. I don't come out particularly often at work, and nobody really mentions it. Everyone just accepts me as female, and that's awesome. I guess, like, maybe I've been on hormones long enough now. Like, a lot of my facial features have changed. A lot of my bodily features have changed. And, yeah, I don't really have much of a problem with it. I don't talk about it too much, but I'm also not afraid to talk about it. At the place where I work, I feel really supported by my peers and by my coworkers as far as, like, being out as a trans person goes, and so I don't really have to project my outness or my gender because I've got that core safe within me.
Right. And you identify as trans, transgender, yeah. Gender fluid, more so than you identify as a woman at this point in your life, or it depends on the situation?
Like, it really varies depending on who I am on any given day.
Hence the fluid nature of it.
Yeah.
Nice.
Like, I definitely identify as female today. And even for, like, the past, like, month or two, who I am might change. The whole thing with, like, my hormones was finding a hormone regimen that would work no matter who I was. Like, some sort of median that, you know, if my personality should change suddenly, that I don't have to change the medications that I'm taking.
Right, right. I want to switch a little bit and talk about your work with TRIP. And so maybe you could start by telling us a bit about what TRIP is and what they do.
The TRIP Project is a harm reduction initiative that operates out of the Queen West Community Health Center. Their primary mandate is to give out safer sex and drug use information to Toronto's dance and nightlife scene. They also do a lot of activism work around safer sex, safer drug use, anti-oppression, and drug user rights within the larger community. I have spoken at the Toronto or the Global Marijuana March / Toronto Freedom Festival twice on behalf of the TRIP Project. I sit on the Toronto Drug Strategy Stigma and Discrimination Working Group, which was a position that I got through my work at TRIP. They do some really amazing work.
What is it about them that you're attracted to?
It's totally peer-based and totally peer-driven, and so the way that they go about things is just real in a way that a lot of services aren't. So when we have, you know, I say we, I haven't actually worked for TRIP for like a year, but, you know, I still like to say we because that's still a part of my life. When we had our monthly planning meetings, everyone would sit down in a room together and we would all just talk it out and we'd all talk out the issues. There was no hierarchy. There was no leader. There's a project coordinator, but that person would actually take on more role of facilitating the things that the volunteers and outreach workers came up with. So it was like, it was super, super street level, super street led by the people who need the services, who are accessing the services, who are able to deliver the services that they've accessed to other people.
You mentioned earlier that you struggle with addiction issues yourself. And I hear you talking about peer-led, advocating for the rights of drug users. Do you see a contradiction in those two experiences at all?
Not at all. I know a lot of functional crack users. I know functional heroin users. I know functional ketamine users. I know functional marijuana users. I know functional alcoholics. And I know functional caffeine addicts. Really, what drugs a person uses does not have nearly as much of an impact on their ability to work with people in other populations as done the social determinants of health that they're experiencing, including things such as marginalization and poverty.
Right. TRIP operates from a harm reduction approach, and many young people who come into the experience or the social service sector have issues, concerns, challenges with drug use. I remember talking to an executive director of a children's mental health agency who said 80% of the clients who came to the agency self-identified as drugs being a concern for them. TRIP operates from a harm reduction point of view. Why that perspective rather than stop doing the drugs?
Because that latter perspective simply does not work. If it did work, people wouldn't use drugs. Drug prohibition has been in effect in Canada since 1908 when they first introduced the Opium Act. And The Opium Act in particular was actually like a racist way of segregating Chinese citizens, Chinese immigrant citizens from white citizens. And it's actually really intense how much of drug prohibition actually has its roots in oppression and racism. But the whole thing behind harm reduction is it's very realistic. It recognizes that people are going to use drugs whether you tell them to or not. If they are going to use drugs, whether you tell them to or not, give them the tools and the information that they need in order to minimize the cost on their lives, on society, on the healthcare system, and on emergency services.
That makes a lot of sense to me.
That makes a lot of sense. Harm reduction is what's considered an evidence-based practice. I don't know why that's such a controversial concept.
And does harm reduction, can it include abstinence?
It totally can include abstinence. It's really about meeting people where they're at. If a person is engaged in chaotic drug use and they want to not be using drugs at all anymore, then that is where they're at. And it's about helping them to access the services and information that they need in order to stop their drug use. But not everybody who's engaged in chaotic drug use wants to stop using drugs. And for some people, maintenance is actually a much more effective form of, well, maintaining their lifestyle.
So harm reduction in and of itself isn't saying you should reduce your drug use or you should stop your drug use as such. It's saying that could be a choice, and your choice might be to maintain your drug use in a way that's going to cause the least amount of harm to yourself.
Yeah. So, like, I was commissioned by a youth serving agency a while ago to author a curriculum of drug education workshops. And in September of 2011, I had the pleasure of actually being able to execute these workshops. Some of the feedback that we got afterwards said stuff like, it's really good that they don't tell us not to do it. It's really good that they tell us what is happening in the brain and what's happening to our bodies, because now that I know what's happening to my body when I take drugs, it will make a difference about how much I do, how long I do it. Really, when you give people the facts about drug use and you give them the agency to make their own decisions, it empowers people to want to look after themselves. Because when you say, all right, here's everything you need to know, and you know what you're doing, then people go, I know what I'm doing. I guess I do know what I'm doing. Yeah, I'm going to do this.
In the time we've been talking, I've seen so much of you embody the journey that you've been speaking about, from the struggles and the depression and the difficulties that you had to where you are now, and what's driven you to get there. And that notion of agency, that notion of information, that idea of listening for and providing for, all the while fighting to do what you need to do, has come through really, really, really clearly. And so I want to thank you very much for sharing some of your many, many, many stories that
yes.
you have. It's been a real pleasure. Anything else you want to say before we wrap up?
Yeah, I just want to say thank you for all the opportunities I've had to work with Connect to Youth, because this program has been a really major influence in my life. It has given me skills that have served me extremely well. It has given me connections that have made my life easier. It has inspired me to do new things and to acquire more responsibility. And Connect to Youth was really a program that served as it was like the bridge between being a street youth and being somebody who delivers services to people, including street youth.
That's great to hear. Thank you very much, Kyan.
Yeah.